Good evening. James McCanny here with my Science Hour. And August 1st, 2013, a lot of interesting topics to talk about tonight. The first, I'm just going to mention briefly, I had been talking about Comet Ison since it was first discovered in September, or first announced, I should say, September 21st of last year, 2012. And one of the things I said, well, this NASA was bloating it as being the comet of the century. They obviously had information that nobody else had, and it was all over the news. Comet of the century, in fact, comet of maybe the last 1,000 years, fill up the entire sky after it comes around the sun. And there again, that's kind of a tenuous thing because before, remember Comet Lovejoy, it surprised NASA in all standard science that a little snowball that they say is a snowball, and of course it's not a snowball, that would survive a passage through the solar atmosphere, come out the other side, and become a much bigger comet. How does that work? Well, of course, they're just dealing with fairy tale science. But then comes along Comet Ison. And I believe they had been watching that for some time before the actual announcement. There were all kinds of very strange things regarding the announcement of Comet Ison. Okay, not the least of which was they said don't start even thinking about it until next November. That's when they would start announcing, and they had panels of scientists that would start announcing events regarding Comet Ison. Then I noticed that, hey, this thing's coming right next to Mars. This is a major comet coming next to the planet Mars in October 1st, and it will start having electrical interactions with Mars early in, probably around mid-September, for sure, around mid-September. So obviously NASA trying to downplay, not even mention, that encounter with Mars. So all kinds of strange things. And then I got to looking at the data. I'm starting to look at NASA's data and that they're using to claim this is going to be the comet of the century. And I said, wait a minute. You know, they have not presented any evidence that would convince me or anybody that this should be the comet of the century. So anyway, they were saying it has a nucleus a couple miles across. Well, one thing NASA is lying about through their teeth is the size of comet nuclei, which they can measure directly using radio telescopes, but they never announced that. They never announced the real data that is available there. But what happens is they use secondary or tertiary effects of the comet, like comet tail dust content, or what they call production. And I'm going, well, wait a minute. They're saying the nucleus is 2 miles across. Hey, Hale-Bopp was 42 miles across, they said. And of course, Hale-Bopp really had a nucleus about 1,000 miles across. So all of the NASA information just didn't add up that this should be the comet of the century. So I said that. I said, NASA has not presented any palatable amount of information that would suggest this should be the comet of the century. Why all the hype? So what's funny now is now space.com just came out with an article, kind of an apologetics article, saying, well, doggone, maybe this won't be the comet of the century. And I was always very careful when I was talking about Comet Ison that this is NASA's prediction that it should be the comet of the century. That wasn't my prediction, but I was using it, pointing out the fact that Comet Ison does have some interesting properties. Not the least of which, we could be in what the ancients called the Red Hand of Death, where Ison is going to be between us and Jupiter on its way out of the solar system, and for a little while we're going to have a very good alignment with the planet Jupiter, the comet Ison up and above us, although it's going to be up and above us, still a significant electrical alignment. Earth, we have a new moon, and then Venus, all in a cross-solar system electrical alignment in early January 2014. And I said, if Comet Ison connects into Jupiter and we connect into that same comet tail, which is possible, it's a remote possibility, we could see sulfur dioxide raining in on Earth. Now, there's an interesting show that I just saw talking about the year 536 A.D. And in that year, the Earth went dark for a number of years. There was mass starvation. The crops failed. Winter was extended. And standard science, of course, has to look for an option on Earth. So they said, oh, it must have been Krakatoa blowing up. And so then they extrapolate back and they go, well, yeah, we think Krakatoa had an explosion about that time. But and there were 20 other major earthbound volcanoes that went off in that year, 536 AD. What that tells me is that there was a major comet that year, that the sky went dark for a number of months. And so standard science would say, well, that's the ash clouds coming from these massive volcanoes. Well, there might have been more going on, but the interesting thing was that sulfur dioxide was measured in high concentrations at both the North and the South Pole in the ice record. And so all of a sudden in the year 536 AD, there was a great deal of influx of sulfur dioxide. And so what I'm saying is that the better possibility is that there was a large comet encounter in 536 AD, blotted out the sun, we went through the comet tail, it had an influx of sulfur dioxide, and the Earth maintained cold for a number of years. It finally recovered. But there was something that, say that happened today, and the crops simply didn't grow. The Earth does not have enough food capable of feeding the 6+ billion people that are out there now. And so also, that's what the ancients talked about, the poisoning of water. That's what wormwood means. It's the poisoner of water. And so just a side note, I've noticed a great increase in people buying water filter supplies and water filters, some of the extra ones. And if you see what's on my webpage, these are items that are made for these kind of events, a water storage facility where you filter and store water, and you can do up to a large capacity. Or the pre-filter, where you would, if you had sulfur dioxide or other chemical in the water, you would pre-filter it before you let that go into your nice, clean gravity water filter. Okay, well, enough of that, but back to Comet Ison. It's interesting to see NASA is trying to soft shoe on this now. They don't want anybody looking at this comet next to Mars in October, and I'll guarantee you, everybody put it on your calendar. Starting mid-September, we're all going to go out and look up into the sky and start looking for Comet Ison. It should be a naked eye visible comet at that time. Maybe a small pair of binoculars in the early morning sky. I will be talking a lot more about that. But I want to get right into the main science topic this week. I said, made an announcement on my page, I would be playing the 1961 The January 17, 1961, President Dwight D. Eisenhower Farewell Address. And I want you to listen to this, because here is Eisenhower giving his final address. It lasts about 16 minutes. And then afterwards is a news reporter that comes on and basically totally whitewashes everything that Eisenhower was trying to tell us. But basically, Eisenhower foretold what's happening today. He warned about the military-industrial complex, but what I want you to listen to, as you listen to this speech of Eisenhower, he mentions the military-industrial complex once, but then he talks about science and scientists and industrialized science and the danger that it poses. And this is what I have been pounding on my show. I have to admit, I have never listened to the Eisenhower speech. I probably listened to it live when I was a little kid, but don't remember it. Didn't put it together at that time. Watched it on black and white TV in the living room with my family. But now listening to it again after all that I have come to understand about science and government-owned monopoly science, which is really owned by the bankers, the European bankers, the Rothschilds that represent the Jesuit Vatican. They are the fund managers. And if you understand world history, you got to read my water book. You have to read the water book because it talks all about this history. And now these same people are vying for control of water of the entire world. So without further ado, I'm going to play the farewell address of President Dwight D. Eisenhower, 1961, as he hands off to Kennedy. And a whole interesting aspect of this is as he hands off to Kennedy the power of the presidency and has a private meeting with Kennedy. I'll be talking about that. And then how the news comes on after Eisenhower's speech and whitewashes it. So this whole thing is going to take about 16 minutes. So here goes. Listen carefully. It's this is a 1961 recording, so it's a little scratchy. Listen carefully and make sure you go to my webpage and listen to this about 10 times in the archives.
Good evening, my fellow Americans. First, I should like to express my gratitude to the radio and television networks for the opportunities they have given me over the years to bring reports and messages to our nation. My special thanks go to them for the opportunity of addressing you this evening. 3 days from now, after half a century in the service of our country, I shall lay down the responsibilities of office as, in traditional and solemn ceremony, the authority of the presidency is vested in my successor. This evening, I come to you with a message of leave-taking and farewell, and to share a few final thoughts with you, my countrymen. Like every other citizen, I wish the new president and all who will labor with him Godspeed. I pray that the coming year will be blessed with peace and prosperity for all. Our people expect their president and the Congress to find essential agreement on issues of great moment, the wise resolution of which will better shape the future of the nation. My own relations with the Congress, which began on a remote and tenuous basis when, long ago, a member of the Senate appointed me to West Point, have since ranged to their intimate during the war and immediate post-war period, and finally to the mutually interdependent during these past 8 years. In this final relationship, the Congress and the administration have, on most vital issues, cooperated well. To serve the nation good, rather than mere partisanship, and so have assured that the business of the nation should go forward. So my official relationship with the Congress ends in a feeling, on my part, of gratitude that we have been able to do so much together. We now stand 10 years past the midpoint of a century that has witnessed 4 major wars among great nations. 3 of these involved our own country. Despite these holocausts, America is today the strongest, the most influential, and most productive nation in the world. Understandably proud of this preeminence, we yet realize that America's leadership and prestige depend not merely upon our unmatched material progress, riches, and military strength, but on how we use our power in the interest of world peace and human betterment. Throughout America's adventure in free government, our basic purposes have been to keep the peace, to foster progress in human achievement, and to enhance liberty, dignity, and integrity among peoples and among nations. To strive for less would be unworthy of a free and religious people. Any failure traceable to arrogance or our lack of comprehension or readiness to sacrifice would inflict upon us grievous hurt, both at home and abroad. progress toward these noble goals is persistently threatened by the conflict now engulfing the world. It commands our whole attention, absorbs our very beings. We face a hostile ideology, global in scope, atheistic in character, ruthless in purpose, and insidious in method. Unhappily, the danger it poses promises to be of indefinite duration. To meet it successfully, there is call for not so much the emotional and transitory sacrifices of crisis, but rather those which enable us to carry forward steadily, surely, and without complaint, the burdens of a prolonged and complex struggle with liberty the stake. Only thus shall we remain, despite every provocation, on our charted course toward permanent peace and human betterment. Crises there will continue to be. In meeting them, whether foreign or domestic, great or small, there is a recurring temptation to feel that some spectacular and costly action could become the miraculous solution to all current difficulties. A huge increase in newer elements of our defenses. Development of unrealistic programs to cure every ill in agriculture. A dramatic expansion in basic and applied research. These and many other possibilities, each possibly promising in itself, may be suggested as the only way to the road we wish to travel. But each proposal must be weighed in the light of a broader consideration, the need to maintain balance in and among national programs. Balance between the private and the public economy. Balance between the cost and hoped for advantages. Balance between the clearly necessary and the comfortably desirable. Balance between our essential requirements as a nation and the duties imposed by the nation upon the individual. Balance between actions of the moment and the national welfare of the future. Good judgment seeks balance in progress. Lack of it eventually finds imbalance and frustration. The record of many decades stands as proof that our people and their government have, in the main, understood these truths and have responded to them well in the face of threat and stress. But threats, new in kind or degree, constantly arise. Of these, I mention two only. A vital element in keeping the peace is our military establishment. Our arms must be mighty, ready for instant action, so that no potential aggressor may be tempted to risk his own destruction. Our military organization today bears little relation to that known of any of my predecessors in peacetime, or indeed by the fighting men of World War II or Korea. Until the latest of our world conflicts, the United States had no armaments industry. American makers of plowshares could, with time and as required, make swords as well. But we can no longer risk emergency improvisation of national defense. We have been compelled to create a permanent armaments industry of vast proportions. Added to this, 3.5 million men and women are directly engaged in the defense establishment. We annually spend on military security alone more than the net income of all United States corporations. Now, this conjunction of an immense military establishment and a large arms industry is new in the American experience. The total influence, economic, political, even spiritual, is felt in every city, every state house, every office of the federal government. We recognize the imperative need for this development, yet we must not fail to comprehend its grave implications. Our toil, resources, and livelihood are all involved. So is the very structure of our society. In the councils of government, we must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
the potential for the disastrous rise of misplaced power exists and will persist. We must never let the weight of this combination endanger our liberties or democratic processes. We should take nothing for granted. Only an alert and knowledgeable citizenry can compel the proper meshing of the huge industrial and military machinery of defense with our peaceful methods and goals, so that security and liberty may prosper together. Akin to and largely responsible for the sweeping changes in our industrial military posture has been the technological revolution during recent decades. In this revolution, research has become central. It also becomes more formalized, complex, and costly. A steadily increasing share is conducted for, by, or at the direction of the federal government. Today, the solitary inventor, tinkering in his shop, has been overshadowed by task forces of scientists in laboratories and testing fields. In the same fashion, the free university, historically the fountainhead of free ideas and scientific discovery, has experienced a revolution in the conduct of research. Partly because of the huge costs involved, a government contract becomes virtually a substitute. In this revolution, research has become central. It also becomes more formalized, complex, and costly. A steadily increasing share is conducted for, by, or at the direction of the federal government. Today, the solitary inventor, tinkering in his shop, has been overshadowed by task forces of scientists in laboratories and testing fields. In the same fashion, the free university, historically the fountainhead of free ideas and scientific discovery, has experienced a revolution in the conduct of research. Partly because of the huge costs involved, a government contract becomes virtually a substitute for intellectual curiosity. For every old blackboard, there are now hundreds of new electronic computers. The prospect of domination of the nation's scholars by federal employment, project allocations, and the power of money is ever present and is gravely to be regarded. Yet in holding scientific research and discovery in respect, as we should, we must also be alert to the equal and opposite danger that public policy could itself become the captive of a scientific, technological elite. It is the task of statesmanship to mold, to balance, and to integrate these and other forces, new and old, within the principles of our democratic system, ever aiming toward the supreme goals of our free society. Another factor in maintaining balance involves the element of time. As we peer into society's future, we, you and I, and our government, must avoid the impulse to live only for today, plundering for our own ease and convenience the precious resources of tomorrow. We cannot mortgage the material assets of our grandchildren without risking the loss also of their political and spiritual heritage. We want democracy to survive for all generations to come, not to become the insolvent phantom of tomorrow. During the long lane of the history yet to be written, America knows that this world of ours, ever growing smaller, must avoid becoming a community of dreadful fear and hate, and be instead a proud confederation of mutual trust and respect. Such a confederation must be one of equals. The weakest must come to the conference table with the same confidence as do we, protected as we are by our moral, economic, and military strength. That table, though scarred by many past frustrations, cannot be abandoned for the certainty agony
of disarmament, of the battlefield. Disarmament with mutual honor and confidence is a continuing imperative. Together we must learn how to compose differences, not with arms, but with intellect and decent purpose. Because this need is so sharp and apparent, I confess that I lay down my official responsibilities in this field with a definite sense of disappointment. As one who has witnessed the horror and the lingering sadness of war, as one who knows that another war could utterly destroy this civilization which has been so slowly and painfully built over thousands of years, I wish I could say tonight that a lasting peace is in sight. Happily, I can say that war has been avoided. Steady progress toward our ultimate goal has been made, but so much remains to be done. As a private citizen, I shall never cease to do what little I can to help the world advance along that road. So in this, my last good night to you as your president, I thank you for the many opportunities you have given me for public service in war and in peace. I trust in that service, you find some things worthy. As for the rest of it, I know you will find ways to improve performance in the future. You and I, my fellow citizens, need to be strong in our faith that all nations under God will reach the goal of peace with justice. May we be ever unswerving in devotion to principle, confident but humble with power, diligent in pursuit of the nation's great goals. To all the peoples of the world, I once more give expression to America's prayerful and continuing aspiration. We pray that peoples of all faiths, all races, all nations, may have their great human needs satisfied, that those now denied opportunity shall come to enjoy it to the full, that all who yearn for freedom may experience its spiritual blessings. Those who have freedom will understand also its heavy responsibility. That all who are insensitive to the needs of others will learn charity, and that the sources, scourges of poverty, disease, and ignorance will be made disappear from the earth. And that in the goodness of time, all peoples will come to live together in a peace guaranteed by the binding force of mutual respect and love. Now, on Friday noon, I am to become a private citizen. I am proud to do so. I look forward to it. Thank you, and good night.
We have presented the farewell address by the President of the United States, Dwight D. Eisenhower, who spoke this evening from his office in the White House.
Good evening, everybody. This is Douglas Edwards. As you just heard, President Eisenhower, in his last good night to the American people as President, cautioned against two threats to our democracy. The first threat he defined as unwarranted influence by an immense military establishment and a vast armaments industry, whether sought or unsought. And he also cautioned against letting public policy become the captive of a scientific and technological elite. He said that while we must respect scientific research and development, like the military, the influence of the scientific must be molded and balanced within the democratic system. The president combined prayerful words for his successor with a warning that the struggle with communism will be long and not subject to any miraculous solution. He said he would never cease to do what little I can to achieve peace and disarmament with mutual honor and confidence. Mr. Eisenhower spoke from a White House office already stripped of most of his personal belongings, including his oil paintings. Tomorrow, he'll hold a farewell news conference. On Thursday, he will discuss transition problems for the second time with President-elect John Kennedy. On Friday, he will attend the inauguration services, and shortly after lunch, he will leave with Mrs. Eisenhower for Gettysburg, Pennsylvania, a private citizen completing 50 years of national service. On this night that the outgoing president assessed the world situation and the nation awaited the words of his successor, Moscow chose to make public a document as important as any issued by the Soviets in the post-war period. It was Premier Khrushchev's official interpretation of the manifesto issued by the Communist Summit meeting called to resolve the ideological conflict between the hard war being inevitable, that's the inevitable line of the Chinese Communists, with a soft, peaceful coexistence approach of the Soviets. Said Khrushchev in briefing Russian party organizations, war is not necessary, that is, not atomic war and not brushfire wars such as the war in Korea. No mention, however, of Laos. Khrushchev did, however, go on fully to approve a third class of war, what he called the War of Liberation. He called the Algerian Rebellion a sacred war, and he added, "We have helped and shall go on helping people fighting for their freedom." The Soviet premier predicted that a victory by communism is not far off, and here he warned that war could come if the capitalist nations resist what is historically inevitable, according to him. He defined peaceful coexistence as an intense struggle by economic, political, and ideological means, and said it is one means of preventing a military conflict with capitalism. Another means he described as the development of peace fronts throughout the world, including pacifists of all political beliefs. Further evidence that the Russians will try to upstage President-elect Kennedy with a spectacular space shot this week has been provided by the Navy. The fourth Soviet RAIN ship has been spotted moving into position in the Pacific. And like the three previously reported vessels, this one carries helicopters, which of course could be used to recover either a missile nose cone or a space capsule. For some time, there's been speculation that the Russians are trying to time a man in space effort to obscure the inauguration here. Mr. Kennedy is back in Washington tonight, attending a gala family party, and otherwise making final preparations for his role in the Inauguration Day ceremonies on Friday. But looking beyond Friday, Republicans are already throwing challenges onto the floor of Congress. Two Republican senators, both from New York State, introduced a 7-point civil rights program today. Senators Javits and Keating of New York then issued a statement urging President-elect Kennedy to back the program and otherwise take the initiative in civil rights cases. One of their colleagues, Senator Cooper of Kentucky, also introduced a civil rights bill.
Okay, this is James McCanney back again. I wanted to play part of the Douglas Edwards news brief after the Eisenhower speech. And what's important there is to see how he, first of all, gives a short summary of what Eisenhower said, but then he moves into the Cold War rhetoric. This is the control of the world bankers. You can see where already in the 1961, this is 1961, the information industry is highly controlled by the banking community, and they want to pump that fear, the Cold War rhetoric, into the minds of the public. So this is totally overshadowing what Eisenhower had said. And so, the whole concept of the world bankers is conflict and resource usage. So what is Edwards saying? He says, we have to fear the Russians, and we have to put a lot of resources into this Cold War to oppose the Russians, who inevitably see us as failing, as they them conquering us. Putting that fear, that Cold War fear, into the American public. Totally overshadowing what Eisenhower just got done saying. So no more were the words out of Eisenhower's mouth regarding the danger internal to the United States of the military-industrial complex. And I want to stress, this is why I played this on my show. Because listen to what Eisenhower said about science, scientists, technological research, government-controlled science, and the danger of that. And that's what I have been pounding on in my books, in my public addresses, in my information, that all of my books. Some people have criticized me, and they say, why don't you just stick to science? If you don't know what causes science, if you don't know what the opposition is, if you don't know why science looks the way it looks today because of the top-down control coming from European bankers, because they want to control the world, and they use science, believe me, when it comes to, like, say, my most recent book, Water. That book is a big part, a discussion of the world control mechanism, and the same groups now that are vying for control of worldwide water resources. How did George Bush Jr. know to go down to South America, buy a 100,000-acre ranch in the middle of Paraguay that sits on top of one of the world's largest water aquifers? He didn't know that. Scientists had to provide all of this water information. It had to filter up into the upper ranks, and then it comes back down to little Georgie, who they send down there to buy some land and procure the water rights. You see how this works. George Bush, Senior, Junior, they're middle management in this whole scheme. I've always said, if you see their names, if you see them as a public figure, they are not in control. The people who are really pulling the strings up there, the marionette masters, you never see. You don't know their names, because I have met some of them. I've met their kids. I've met the families. And believe me, they don't appear anywhere in any public record. So the Obama's middle management, you know, he's a middle manager. The congressman, less than middle management. They are just window dressing, as one of them put it. And so if you write to your congressman, you may as well write a letter to the wall over there. It has nothing to do with what's going to happen or who's controlling the world. But you see Douglas Edwards here, and I look at him and I think, is that guy a relative of John Edwards, the politician? Maybe someone out there can research that. But here, you know, who is in the news media? Who is in politics? You don't get to that level without buttering the plate of the people way up on top. But listen to Eisenhower's speech, and I want people to go back and listen on my archive page. Listen to that speech over and over again. He starts, and he's very definite about the military-industrial complex. He explains how it developed, why it is what it is today, and the need for a strong defense. But then he says, don't let this baby overtake it, because it can become an entity for its own needs and desires, controlling world situations. Remember, Big Oil happened after Eisenhower. Big Oil was already in place, of course, through World War II, through World War I. And big energy was very important. The nuclear industry was burgeoning, the use of nuclear power for private energy was coming into vogue. All of this happening as Eisenhower left office. I want to talk just a second, but let me finish my statement there about science. He spent most of his time talking about science, the control of science, modern technological research funded by the government, and the dangers. He mentioned agriculture. Isn't that interesting? Today we have monster international corporations, Monsanto, Cargill, the list goes on, which are forcing their way into government policy, into government agencies, forcing their bizarre Frankenstein agriculture on the world through just unbelievably brutal techniques and independent. Okay, he talked about the public's knowledge, so that the only way this can be defended is through broad public knowledge. Why do you think the people on the very top, through public education, keep the public stupid about science? The dirty snowball comet model. What an absurdly ridiculous concept. The vapor pressure is zero in outer space, and so if you get any type of elevated temperature at all, all that water is going to be gone in a New York second. The only reason ice is going to exist in outer space on an entity is because it has gravitational mass and a gravitational field sufficient to hold that in place. And the little comet nuclei, there's no water there. There's no water to form a tail. There's no dust coming off. The plasma discharge comet model explains why you have a nucleus that's black tar surface and then still has a tail. I mean, this dirty snowball comet model is the epitome of fairy tale science. But all of the news media, all of space.com, spaceweather.com, all of the so-called respectable journals, the universities with space science, all vying for this concept. And why? Because they gotta. There's no other option. And I'll tell you, there's a lot of them that believe in it. But they're just in this, it's like somebody removed their brain someplace in graduate school and put another automaton brain in there, and once they learn something, they can't unlearn it or change it. Scientists today their brains aren't there. Like I was talking to a scientist at an American Geophysical Union meeting, and he was surrounded by graduate students. And I was pointing to a volcano that was on my poster at the American Geophysical Union meeting where I was presenting, and I was saying, look, the lightning is outside of the volcanic plume. This is not coming from any activity inside the volcanic plume. And all the graduate students are looking there listening to me, understanding, and he goes, well, no, it's in the churning of the upwelling volcanic plume. It's where the electricity is developed. And I'm like, it's shooting out of the plume. Batteries don't have electricity shooting out of them. If anything, they will discharge internally. And the students repeated me. They said, look, it's coming out of the plume. It can't be generated in the plume. They understood. But here's their head guy, their mentor, demanding that they agree with him. And they all walked away, and I think they all had a learning experience, because maybe for the first time in their lives, their concepts were challenged. The basis of what they were being taught was being challenged. But to stay in those programs, they had to learn, they had to take their brain out and replace it with something else, and learn all of this ridiculously bad science, and then continue to promote it to get their PhDs. So you see these meetings, but government-supported science, and Eisenhower says that right in his speech. I mean, this is just amazing. I wanted to play this on my radio show. As I said, I had never heard the full Eisenhower speech. I probably did when I was a kid, but you know, since then I had not listened to it. But a listener sent this in this past week. And said, interesting, here's the full speech, plus the news commentary afterwards with Douglas Edwards. And so I listened to it, and I thought, oh, my man, you know, you hear always that Eisenhower warned against the military-industrial complex. But nobody talks about the real warning. The military-industrial complex wouldn't be anything if it were not for the scientists and engineers who go in there, do their piece of the work, compartmentalized, and have no idea where that scientific research is being used or how it is being used, and they don't have any control over it. They are simply working for a paycheck and a retirement, and when they get all done, they think, oh, I've defended my country, I've done a good job, not realizing that when they get done with their research, somebody is taking that over to Russia and selling it to the Russians. The Russians would have never in a million years kept up with Western technology when it was rolling and the computer stuff and everything else. The Russians would have never in a million years kept up with the aircraft, all of the other control systems, missile, and all of that were developed in the United States. if it weren't for the World Banker little people that would move back and forth between Russia and the United States selling trade secrets almost the day they were invented and put on paper, they were moved to Russia. Well, why would they do that? Because that is important to keep that balance of fear. It's not a balance of power. It's a balance of fear. The Russians fear us. We fear them. And guess who's loaning the money to cover all of this? This tremendous amount of research, this tremendous amount of government-controlled science, and then all of the good stuff goes up the ladder to the world bankers who are controlling through loans to the countries. When I was a kid, they talked about the national debt. And I thought, well, gee, we owe somebody there that's loaning us money. And then I realized that all the countries in the world have national debt, that they're loaned money. The money in the country is loaned. And then I thought, man, who is this guy that's got so much money he can loan it to all of the countries of the world? In the United States, supposedly the most powerful country in the world, we're getting loans from this guy. This guy's got buco bucks. This guy's got serious deep pockets. Who's this guy that's got so much money he can loan it to all the countries of the world, and we all owe him? In Russia, in the United States, in the, you know, Afghanistan, France, everybody owes this guy money. Who is this dude? Well, the name is Rothschild. In the United States, it's the Rockefellers. You know, you go down the channel a ways, a little bit down farther, it's the Bushes. It's the Case, the Chase, the Morgans, the whole laundry list of these rich people that have come and gone through history managing the European banks in the United States and in all these other countries. This, I keep telling people, the CIA is not some kind of organization that's protecting the United States internationally. They are the international police force of the CIA is the international police force of the world bankers in the United States. You go to another country, you know, they're there. What are they doing? They are protecting the monetary systems of the world. They are creating conflict. They're putting puppets in governments in foreign countries that will do their bidding. This is it's absolutely incredible the amount of money that is being spent to produce fairy tale science. Okay, let's take one example. An American Geophysical Union, they do it twice a year. There's 15 to 17,000 scientists there from around the world. This is the tier two science. This is the garbage science to give the illusion that there's science going on. It has nothing to do with the reality of science. Absolutely nothing. And the real science is up the ladder, and you never see it. You never hear about it. You don't know who the scientists are that are doing it, nor do you see their equipment or have access to it. You don't really know what's going on behind the scenes. And so the tier two fairy tale garbage science that's pawned off on the public in all of these meetings and scientists flying around the world presenting things, there is scientific, so-called scientific information. It's all a big smokescreen because it has nothing to do with reality. And the biggest part of it is they maintain phony science for a reason. That's to keep the public stupid. The Eisenhower touched on this briefly. He said you need an informed public to combat the military-industrial complex and all that goes with it. Do you think that Eisenhower really wanted to say something at that point? He talked about communism clearly in vague terms. But how much was he aware of the Cold War being controlled by the bankers? He met with Kennedy in the next day or so after this speech. Eisenhower met with Kennedy to debrief and how to prepare the country for the future. Do you think they talked about the banks and the banking system and the control? Kennedy, through his dad and his family connections, John Kennedy knew who the bankers were. He knew what the Federal Reserve was. He knew who the CIA was. He knew that they were not there to protect him. Into Kennedy's term, very shortly into the Kennedy's term, he signed directives, presidential directives. One was to eliminate the Federal Reserve as the national banking system. The other one was to eliminate the CIA. Well, about a day later, he was dead. They put bullets through his head front and backwards and sideways, and then blamed it on a guy named Lee Harvey Oswald, who was set up. Obviously, and then the Warren Commission comes along, does a phony, completely phony investigation, just like the phony investigation of 9/11. And, you know, here's Eisenhower warning exactly of the situation of 9/11, where the country is basically overtaken. Eisenhower warned against that. He said, listen to his speech. Listen to all the innuendos that Eisenhower put out there regarding, he basically foretold what was going to happen to this country. But he said an informed citizenry is necessary to continually combat this, because it's always going to be there. It's going to always be knocking on the door. And the informed citizenry has to combat this. Right now, we are in a tremendously horrible situation in the United States. The Snowden incidents, where he is releasing information, and I've listened to quite a few of his conversations, you would call them. Basically, he said that they record everything you do, and now it's come out that YouTube, Yahoo, Google, Facebook, Twitter, all of these social medias, everything you do, Skype, everything you do on these is recorded. And the reason, and this is what I've been saying all along, and Snowden reiterated it, was that they record everything. Because if someday you become suspect of something, they can go back 10 years or 5 years or whatever and listen to every conversation you have had on your phone and then mold it into making a suspect out of you. If you, every conversation you had, every internet search you had, you could be brought before a trial without judge and jury, and basically they could say, look at this person is obviously developing into a terrorist. He's had terrorist motivations, and we have to kill him. This is where it's going. And, you know, and 95% of the people out there are simply brain dead, have no thoughts at all, and don't present any potential problem for the people in control. It's that 5% element out there that they're afraid of, because they know revolutions are not started and executed by 95% of the people. Those people are out there walking up and down the street and don't have a clue of anything. It's that 5% that know what's going on and know that the tyranny is going on, the mental tyranny of the leaders, and it's that 5% that's going to go out there and take those people to the cleaners and get them out of there, and their ride's going to be over, literally. So Eisenhower is warning about all of this. Little could he foresee the day when there would be enough computer memory capacity to record every conversation of every person that's going on all day long, and everything they do on their computers, and all of their the photographs that they send on their cell phone, where they are, their cell phone record of GPS tracks where people were. Everything you do, every place you go, everything you're doing is being tracked and recorded. And for example, the phones now will remember things, so even if your phone is turned off for a while, when it comes back on, it gets back to reporting. GPS, a lot of people don't know this. If you're in an area where you do not have phone signal, your GPS is still working, and your phone still knows where you are based on GPS signals. Anyway, I got a few minutes left on my show here, but a lot of other topics I'd like to cover tonight, but this is a big, big show for me. To play Eisenhower's speech, to give a little bit of commentary, to see Douglas Edwards come on after Eisenhower and completely twist what he's saying, giving that Cold War rhetoric to make the country, you know, we've got to fear this. Kennedy is a young president. They're going to test him. They're going to overshadow him. The Republicans come in with their 2 cents. They were talking about the social issues in the United States at the time. And the overshadowing of everything that Eisenhower said. Very important. So I'd like you to go back and listen to this show again. Listen to that Eisenhower speech. And there are some versions on the internet, but I got the full version here. And so listen to it, understand what he is saying, and listen what he's saying about science. He talks about the military-industrial complex, gives his warning, and then he goes into the science, the individual scientists and creativity, the universities being the prior being a bastion of creativity, where the guy is pursuing knowledge for knowledge's sake. That's the old model of the university. I just want to give a quick story here. I was at an American Geophysical Union meeting one time. I was setting up my presentation and everything, and next to me were people from Goddard Space Flight Center. And I know that most of the people there, and we were dealing with Hale-Bopp and some of the issues of Hale-Bopp, including the X-rays. This is back in the mid-90s. And there was a woman there who had just gotten her PhD, and she saw my badge, and she looks at it, and she goes, "Independent scientists, what's your association?" Because everybody had Goddard or University or whatever, their name plus their association. And she said, "Independent scientists." She said, "What does that mean?" She says, "I said, I'm independent. I fund my own research. I don't work for any agency. I'm not in any university or whatever." And she couldn't imagine this. She says, How do you function? How do you operate without government funding? It's totally devoid of the mentality of scientists today to operate as science was before. But you hear Eisenhower talking about that during his term, that change came into place. Remember to go to my webpage. Everybody has to read my water book. Water, it's the ebook there. There's 3 ways to purchase it. I also have to tell you, you got to read all the books to really understand that, the water book. And remember the water filter products. I'm telling people, start getting ready. And I think there's going to be a false flag event this fall where they're going to pull the electric plug based on a false solar flare. That looks like it's coming. That's all I can tell you. You got to be prepared. But the webpage, JMCC, S as in Sam, C as in Charlie, I as in Indigo.com, JMCCSCI.com. This is Jim McCanny. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.